How do they do it? Perhaps by picking up subtle hints from the faces and postures of their opponents. Poker players speak of reading the tell of another player, sensing when they are bluffing and when they aren't, while maintaining a poker face of their own. Perhaps most people who play rock, paper, and scissors have a tell that they can't control, and that the best players pick up at the last instant. So what is the best strategy to use to prevent your opponent from picking up a pattern from your outer demeanor? Playing absolutely randomly is the best, since if you play a random sequence of moves, there is simply no pattern for your opponent to detect. While you are playing randomly and breaking even, you can try to find a pattern in your opponent's moves and use that pattern to craft a non-random strategy and then strike. People are notoriously bad at creating actual random series. They tend to switch too often, avoiding choosing the same move two or three times in a row, for instance, which ought to occur fairly often in a genuinely random series. Knowing that your casual effort to create a genuinely patternless series is apt to fail, you should consider a better strategy. Get a table of random numbers from the library or online, put your finger at random somewhere on the table, and copy down the next 100 digits. Throw out all the zeros, say, and then replace each 1, 2, or 3 with R for rock, each 4, 5, and 6 with P for paper, and each 7, 8, and 9 with S for scissors. This will give you a sequence of approximately 90 moves, since you threw out approximately 10 zeros, which should be enough for a match. Now you're ready to play, and the cardinal rule is, keep your list secret. If your opponent gets to peek at it, you will be completely at her mercy. As the saying goes, she will turn you into a money pump. If she has no way of getting at your list, on the other hand, she will have to start trying to second-guess you, anticipating your line of thinking as best she can. In short, she will have to treat you from the intentional stance and reason about your reasoning instead of treating you as a simple mechanism whose behavior she can reliably read off your list. This simple principle of keeping your intended choices secret from your opponent turns out to be one of the central pivots in the long-standing controversies over free will. In fact, the invention of game theory by von Neumann and Morgenstern, 1944, began with the recognition that while a solitary agent, or intentional system, trying to predict the future from the information it gathers, can get by with a calculation of expected utility, using probability theory, of one sort or another, as soon as there are two agents, two intentional systems in the environment, the circumstance is changed radically. Now, each agent has to take into account the attempts at prediction by the other agent, and include the other agent's observation of, and attempts to anticipate and exploit, its own behavior, creating feedback loops of indefinite complexity. This fundamental fog of inscrutability or unpredictability of agents by each other creates the conditions in which game theory flourishes. Evolution has discovered this, and many species can be seen to apply the principles of game theory, competence without comprehension, in their interactions. Gazelle stotting is just one simple example. Another is the erratic flight of butterflies, whose trajectories are hard for insectivorous birds to predict, though evolution has helped the birds by giving them a faster flicker fusion rate than we have, for instance. They see more frames per second than we do. A movie would look like a slideshow to them. Be unpredictable and look out for others following this advice. Appreciation of this principle can be seen in the widespread instinct found in animals who, when confronted with any complicated moving entity, try to treat it as an agent. Who goes there and what do you want? Not just, what's that, in order to be safe, because maybe it is an agent and it wants to eat the animal, or to mate with it, or to fight over some prize. This instinctual response is the source and evolution of the invention of all the invisible elves, goblins, leprechauns, fairies, ogres, and gods that eventually evolve into God, the ultimate invisible intentional system. Dennett, 2006a. Like animals who adopt this strategy without having to know why, we human beings appreciate the tactic of preserving our unpredictability without having to understand why this is such a good idea. But it's pretty obvious most of the time. When you are shopping and spot an antique that you have to have, You know better than to gush over it before you've learned the selling price. You'll get scalped by the seller if you don't. When you advertise something for sale, you put a reasonable asking price on it, one you would be content to receive, because you can't tell when a buyer would actually pay more, and you hope that the buyer can't tell how much less you would accept than your asking price. You can refuse to bargain, of course. Auctions are ways of exploring this terra incognita, and if you trust the auctioneer with an advance bid, you are counting on his integrity not to reveal your maximum to the other bidders. Similarly, when you fall head over heels in love at first sight of somebody, you do your best not to swoon and pant, keeping as reserved and casual as possible. You don't want to scare this paragon off, or, alternatively, let this delight have too much of the upper hand, wrapping you around her little finger. A poker face is not just for poker. In general, you improve your chances of getting what you want by keeping the competition, the other agents in the neighborhood, off balance, so they don't have good enough hunches about which way you're going to leap to prepare for your landing. It's costly to prepare another agent's environment, so your opponents won't try to anticipate you unless they have very good evidence of what you will do. Magicians know how to do a psychological force to get you to pick from the deck, of your own free will, the card they want you to take. There are many methods, all subtle and hard to detect, and a really good magician can do it most of the time. This is a genuine abridgment of your agency, a manipulation that turns you into a tool, a pawn, an extension of the magician's will, not a free agent. Contrary to ancient ideology, we don't want our free choices to be utterly uncaused. What we all want, and should want, is that when we act based on good information about the best options available to us. If only the environment will cause us to have lots of relevant true beliefs about what's out there, and also cause us to act on the most judicious assessment of that evidence we could achieve. That would give us almost everything we want as agents, except this. We wouldn't want the environment to include a manipulative agent that usurps control from us, so we wouldn't want the environment to make our best moves too obvious to all the other agents out there, for then they can exploit us, knowing too much about what we want and how much we want it. So add to our wish list the capacity to keep our thought processes and our decisions to ourselves, even if it means, on occasion, choosing our second best option, just to keep the others off balance. Clegg, 2012, provides a pioneering formal analysis of this. Some people, dimly appreciating the importance of this unpredictability, think that, just to be safe, they should hold out for absolute unpredictability, which can be achieved only if, down in the basement of our brains, matters are physically indeterministic. Here is how the philosopher Jerry Fodor, 2003, once put it with characteristic vividness. One wants to be what tradition has it that Eve was when she bit the apple, perfectly free to do otherwise. So perfectly free, in fact, that even God couldn't tell which way she had jumped. Page 18. But why does one want this? Is this absolute unpredictability any better, really, than practical unpredictability? Many philosophers over several thousand years have insisted on absolute unpredictability as a condition of genuine free will. Do they know something that we don't know? If so, they are keeping it secret. To almost all of them, the idea that free will is incompatible with determinism has seemed too obvious to need an argument. I say that the burden of proof is on them. Show us why we ought to despair if we can't have absolute unpredictability. I've shown why we, like evolution itself, are wise to arrange for as much practical unpredictability as we can. Tell us, please, why that is not enough. I will give you one good reason. If you plan to play rock, paper, and scissors with God, for high stakes, salvation maybe, then you have reason. Just as Fodor says, to want perfect freedom. I, for one, don't anticipate that contest, so I am content with the practical freedom I have by just keeping my counsel and staying away from sleight-of-hand artists and other manipulators when the stakes are high. 68. Two lotteries. Compare the following two lotteries for fairness. In lottery A, for after, all the tickets are sold, their stubs are placed in a suitable mixer, and mixed as randomly as you like, and then the winning ticket is blindly drawn. Most lotteries we encounter are like this. In Lottery B, for before, the mixing of stubs and the blind drawing of the winner takes place before the tickets are sold and the winning stub is put in a safe. But otherwise, the lotteries are conducted the same way. Someone might think the second lottery is unfair because the winning ticket is determined before people even buy their tickets. One of those tickets is already the winner. Even if nobody knows which one, the other tickets are worthless paper, and selling them to unsuspecting people is some sort of fraud. But in fact, both lotteries are equally fair. Everyone who buys a ticket has an equal chance of winning. The timing of the selection of the winner is an utterly inessential feature. The drawing in most lotteries is postponed until after the sale of the tickets in order to provide the public with first-hand eyewitness evidence that there have been no shenanigans. No sneaky person with inside knowledge has manipulated the distribution of tickets, because the knowledge of the winning ticket did not and could not exist in any agent until after the tickets were sold. It is interesting that not all lotteries follow this practice. Publishers Clearing House used to mail out millions of envelopes each year that had written on them in bold letters, "You may already have won $1 million or some other prize." The organization now runs its lottery largely online. These expensive campaigns are based on market research showing that, in general, people do think lotteries with pre-selected winners are fair so long as they are honestly conducted. But perhaps people go along with these lotteries uncomplainingly because they get their tickets for free. Would many people buy a ticket in a lottery in which the winning stub, sealed in a special envelope, was known to have been deposited in a bank vault from the outset? People buy scratch tickets by the millions, and whether or not any ticket is a winner is already determined when it is bought. Apparently, these people consider themselves to have a real opportunity to win. I think they are right. But whether they are right or wrong, their calm conviction that such lotteries are fair and that they have a real opportunity to win should undo the confidence of the philosophers, going back 2 millennia to Democritus and Lucretius, who have somehow convinced themselves that no opportunity is a real opportunity unless the outcome is undetermined up to the last instant. These philosophers have maintained that without a continuing supply of truly random, undetermined branch points to break up the fabric of causation, there is no possibility of free choices, no real chances to do the right thing. The two lotteries give us a new perspective on the problem of determinism. If the world is determined, then we have pseudo-random number generators in us, not truly quantum mechanical random randomizers. If our world is determined, all our lottery tickets were drawn at once, in effect, about 14 billion years ago at the moment of the Big Bang, put in an envelope for us, and doled out as we needed them through life. Whenever you need to flip a coin or in some less ostentatious way make a chancy decision, your brain opens the envelope and takes out the next random number, letting its value determine what you do, just like the list of moves in rock, paper, and scissors. "But that is unfair," someone may say. For some people will have been dealt more winners than others. Indeed, on any particular deal, some people have more high cards than others. But one should remember that in the long run, the luck averages out. But if all the drawings take place before we are born, some people are determined to get more luck than others. That will be true. However, even if the drawings are not held before we are born, but periodically, on demand, throughout our lives, even in a perfectly random and unbiased drawing, a genuinely undetermined drawing, it is still determined that some people will get more winners than others. Even in a perfectly fair, perfectly random coin-tossing tournament, it is determined that someone or other will win, and everybody else in the tournament will lose. The winner cannot properly claim it was his destiny to win, but whatever advantages accrue to winning are his, destiny or not. And what could be fairer than that? Fairness does not consist in everybody winning. Probably the most frequently cited reason for hoping for indeterminism is that without it, when we choose an act, we could not have done otherwise. And surely, ding, that is something that should be important to us. This, too, is not as obvious as it has often seemed. And in order to get a glimpse at how this familiar idea might be misleading us, consider the curious category of inert historical facts. 69. Inert historical facts. An inert historical fact is any fact about a perfectly ordinary arrangement of matter in the world at some point in the past that is no longer discernible. A fact that has left no footprints at all in the world today. My favorite example of an inert historical fact is this. A. Some of the gold in my teeth once belonged to Julius Caesar. Or maybe this. B. It is false that some of the gold in my teeth once belonged to Julius Caesar. Now, logic tells us one of these two must be a fact. Hang on. Wasn't the moral of the sorta operator chapter that we should distrust these obvious disjunctions? Let's check this one out. How could it be the case that neither A nor B had a clear claim on truth? Well, what if ownership in Caesar's day was either vague or ill-defined, so that Caesar only sorta owned some of his gold? Perhaps the way the Queen of England to this day is the owner of all the swans in the land. Assuming that the relevant concept of ownership is nicely demarcated, the way the concept of gold is, one of the two sentences must express a fact. But which of the two is true is almost certainly not discoverable by any physical investigation, no matter how sophisticated it is, and no matter how long it takes to conduct it. Really? We can imagine cases where we could be almost certain that either A or B is the true alternative. If it turned out that because of various well-recorded historical processes, the provenance of some of the gold in my teeth was scrupulously controlled and recorded through the millennia, like the chain of custody for exhibits of evidence in murder trials, we could be quite sure that A is true. Let's say that my dentist purchased an ancient gold ring from a museum, the famous Caesar's pinky ring, which a host of documents attest had been handed down over the centuries from monarch to monarch until it arrived in the museum. And there is a videotape showing the dentist melting the ring and pouring the molten gold into the plaster cast for my filling. Outlandish, sure, but clearly within the bounds of physical possibility. Or, alternatively, suppose that I am a gold-panning hobbyist and made a trip to the base of a receding glacier in Alaska that had covered the land for 10,000 years, where I carefully collected all the gold that subsequently went into my teeth. Then B would be even more certainly the truth. But if nothing like these extreme tales is well evidenced, then it is as good as certain that we could never know which of A or B is true. The true one, whichever it is an inert historical fact. Quantum physics raises an interesting difficulty. Even if the trajectory of each atom of gold in my teeth could be traced back through the centuries, if there were occasions when two or more gold atoms, one from the Caesar legacy and one from outside sources, collided, or just got very close to each other, it would be impossible in principle to tell which atom was which after the collision. Atoms and smaller particles don't have anything like fingerprints or other distinguishing characteristics and cannot be continuously tracked. So the continuing identity of particles does not always make sense, adding another barrier to knowing the facts about the gold. Now, whether or not the whole universe is deterministic, computers are designed to be deterministic. In the face of submicroscopic noise and even quantum randomness, absorbing these fluctuations by being digital, not analog. We had a vivid example of that with Conway's Game of Life in Chapter 66, but digital determinism is everywhere. The fundamental idea behind digitizing in order to produce determinism is that we can create inert historical facts by design, forcibly sorting all the pivotal events into two categories. High versus low, on versus off, zero versus one, guarantees that the micro differences between different high voltages, different flavors of being on, different shades of zero, are ruthlessly discarded. Nothing is allowed to hinge on them, and they vanish without a trace. Facts about actual historical variations that make no difference at all to the subsequent series of states through which the computer passes. For instance, your friend downloads a song from a website and burns it onto two CDs. These two unlabeled CDs, we'll call them A and B, but we won't write their names on them, will be digital duplicates, of course. Ask him to copy one of them onto your laptop in a pitch-black room. Don't tell him which CD to use, and have him handle both CDs after completing the action, wiping out the possibility of using fingerprint evidence or DNA traces before depositing them in a bag full of other CDs and shaking it vigorously. Now we have two candidate inert historical facts. A. Your laptop has a copy made from the A disk. B. Your laptop has a copy made from the B disk. Any actual physical encoding of the bitstream of the song will have a microscopically fine structure that differs from the fine structure of any other encoding. And when you copy one of the CDs to RAM, random access memory, the voltage patterns in RAM will also have a unique fine structure. And if we then copy the file from RAM to a hard disk or a flash drive, these too will contain microscopic differences that distinguish them. What is conveniently called copying is always the creation of yet another continuous or analog physical signal that has its own unique fine structure, because that's the way the world is way down among the electrons and protons. But the genius of digitization is that all this fine structure is ignored, wiped out in the correction to the norm. When you have norms, like an alphabet, it doesn't make any difference what flavor the individual symbols have. They all read the same. In a computer, it's all zeros and ones. So, unless one of the CDs happens to have an error discernible at the level of the digital idealization, has a flipped bit, that is, a zero instead of a one or vice versa, there will be no way of telling. The digitization prevents the propagation of the individuality of the two CDs to later versions and ultimately to the digital-to-analog conversion that drives the speakers or earbuds. Some music lovers are reputed to be golden-eared, able to tell vinyl records from the best digital CDs and compressed, for example, MPEG, from uncompressed digital files. But no music lover could do better than chance if asked whether two successive playings of some music were from the same or different CDs. That is an inert historical fact, undetectable, not just by human ears, but by electron microscopy of the fine structure of their copies in RAM. Any human being who could do this would be a strong candidate for having supernatural ESP, since digitization creates a physical barrier to the information transmission that would enable a guesser to do better than chance. Because a computer is a digital device, it is trivial to get it to execute a few trillion steps and then place it back in exactly the same digital state it was in before, and watch it execute exactly the same few trillion digital steps again and again and again. Wait a minute, comes an objection. You say computers are deterministic? You can get them to replay exactly the same trillion steps over and over? Give me a break. Then why does my laptop crash every so often? Why does my word processor freeze on Tuesday when I was doing the very same thing that worked just fine on Monday? You weren't doing the very same thing. It froze not because it is indeterministic, but because it was not in exactly the same state on Tuesday that it was in on Monday. Your laptop must have done something in the interval that raised a hidden flag or called up some part of the word processor that had never before been activated by you, which flipped a bit somewhere that got saved in its new position when you shut down. And now the word processor has stubbed its toe on that tiny change and crashed. And if you somehow manage to put it back in exactly the same Tuesday morning state a second time, it will crash again. What about the random number generator? I thought my computer had a built-in device for creating randomness on demand. Every computer these days comes equipped with a built-in random number generator that can be consulted whenever needed by any program running on it. Before there were computers, you could buy a book that was nothing but a table of random numbers to use in your research. Page after page of digits that had been scrupulously generated in such a way as to pass all the tests of randomness that mathematicians had devised. Of course, each copy of a particular edition of such a book had exactly the same sequence of random numbers in it. Rand Corporation published one of the best books in 1955. It consisted of 1,000,000 random digits. The sequence of numbers generated by a so-called random number generator isn't really random, but just pseudo-random. It is mathematically compressible in the sense that this infinitely long sequence can be captured in a finitely specified mechanism that will crank it out. Suppose, for instance, your random number generator is a program that can be specified in, say, a megabyte, 8 million bits, but it generates a sequence, the same sequence every time, that is actually infinite. If you wanted to send somebody this infinite series, you wouldn't have to do so in an infinitely long email message, recording the series verbatim. You could just send them your megabyte-long algorithm, and they'd have access to the entire infinite series. That is the fundamental idea of a pseudo-random number generator. Whenever you start the random number generator from a cold start, whenever you reboot your computer, for instance, it will always yield exactly the same sequence of digits, but a sequence that is as apparently patternless as if it were generated by genuinely random quantum fluctuations. It is a built-in table of random numbers, you might say, rather like what you would get on a very long loop of videotape, recording the history of a fair roulette wheel over millions of spins. The loop always returns to the beginning when you start up your computer. Sometimes this matters. Computer programs that avail themselves of randomness at various choice points will nevertheless spin out exactly the same sequence of states if run over and over again from a cold start. And sometimes, if you want to test a program for bugs, you will always test the same random sample of states, unless you take steps, easy enough, to jog the program to dip elsewhere now and then into the stream of digits for its next random number. 70. A computer chess marathon. It is fiendishly difficult to think clearly about determinism and choice. If determinism is true, are there ever any real choices? If an agent that apparently has free will is actually deterministic, living in a deterministic world, does this remove all choice, all opportunity? Here is an intuition pump that explores the question by looking at a simplified world, chess playing, in an artificially constructed, deterministic world, the world of activity performed by a computer. Suppose you install two different chess playing programs on your computer and yoke them together with a little supervisory program that pits them against each other game after game in a potentially endless series. Will they play the same game over and over until you turn off the computer? You could set it up like that, but then you wouldn't learn anything interesting about the two programs, A and B. Suppose A beats B in this oft-repeated game. You couldn't infer with each other game after game in a potentially endless series. Will they play the same game over and over until you turn off the computer? You could set it up like that, but then you wouldn't learn anything interesting about the two programs, A and B. Suppose A beats B in this oft-repeated game. You couldn't infer from this that A is a better program in general than B, or that A would beat B in a different game. And you wouldn't be able to learn anything from the exact repetition about the strengths and weaknesses of the two different programs. Much more informative would be to set up the tournament so that A and B play a succession of different games. This can be readily arranged. If either chess program consults the random number generator during its calculations, if, for instance, it periodically flips a coin to escape from situations where it has no handy reason for doing one thing versus another in the course of its searching for a good move, then, in the following game, the state of the random number generator will have changed, unless you arrange to have it reinitialized. And hence, different alternatives will be explored, in a different order, leading on occasion to different moves being chosen. A variant game will blossom, and the third game will be different in different ways, resulting in a series in which no two games, like no two snowflakes, are alike. Nevertheless, if you turned off the computer and then restarted it running the same program, exactly the same variegated series of games would spin out, because the same pseudo-random series of numbers would determine all the coin flips used by both programs. Suppose then we set up such a chess universe involving two programs, A and B, and study the results of a run of, say, 1,000 games. We will find lots of highly reliable patterns. Suppose we find that A always beats B in 1,000 different games. That is a pattern that we will want to explain in saying, since the program is deterministic, A was caused always to beat B would utterly fail to address our very reasonable curiosity. We will want to know what it is about the structure, the methods, the dispositions of A that accounts for its superiority at chess. A has a competence or power that B lacks, and we need to isolate this interesting factor. It might be that the explanation lies at a low level. It might turn out, for instance, that program A and program B are actually the same program, identical chess move evaluators at the source code level. But program A is more efficiently compiled than B, so that it can explore the game further than program B can in the same number of machine cycles. In effect, A thinks exactly the same thoughts about chess as B, and B knows everything about chess that A does, but A just thinks faster. Serious chess, tournament chess, is always played with a time clock. If you run out of time before you've made all your moves, you lose. More likely, the superiority of A to B would require explanation at a higher level perspective at which the everyday topics of chess decision-making appear. Representations of board positions, evaluations of possible continuations, decisions about which continuations to pursue further, and so forth. Thus, program A may adjust the relative value of its pieces as the game progresses, or have better evaluation functions of board positions, or decide to terminate certain sorts of explorations earlier or later. It doesn't think the same thoughts as B, it thinks better, more sophisticated thoughts. It sort of thinks these thoughts, of course. It isn't a conscious person. It might actually be more telling if one program didn't always win. Suppose A almost always beats B, and suppose A evaluates moves using a different set of principles. Then we would have something even more interesting to explain. To investigate this causal question, we would need to study the history of the 1,000 different games looking for further patterns. We would be sure to find plenty of them. Some of them would be endemic to chess wherever it is played. For example, the near certainty of B's loss in any game where B falls a rook behind. And some of them would be peculiar to A and B as particular chess players. For example, B's penchant for getting its queen out too early. We would find the standard patterns of chess strategy, such as the fact that when B's time is running out, B searches less deeply in the remaining nodes of the game tree than it does when it has more time remaining and is in the same local position. In short, we would find a cornucopia of explanatory regularities, some exceptionalist in our run of 1,000 games, and others statistical. These recognizable chess move patterns are salient moments in the unfolding of a deterministic pageant that, observed from the perspective of microcausation, is pretty much all the same. What from one vantage point appear to us to be two chess programs in suspenseful combat can be seen through the microscope, as we watch instructions and data streaming through the computer's CPU, to be a single deterministic automaton unfolding in the only way it can, its jumps already predictable by examining the precise state of the pseudo-random number generator and the rest of the program and data. There are no real forks or branches in its future. All the choices made by A and B are already determined by the total state of the computer and its memory. Nothing, it seems, is really possible in this world other than what actually happens. Suppose, for instance, that an ominous mating net, a guaranteed win that might be hard to discern, looms over A at time T, but it collapses when B runs out of time and terminates its search for the key move one pulse too soon. That mating net was never going to happen. This is something we could prove, if we doubted it, by running exactly the same tournament another day. At the same moment in the series, B would run out of time again and terminate its search at exactly the same point. So what are we to say? Is this toy world really a world without prevention or avoidance, without offense and defense, without lost opportunities, without the thrust and parry of genuine agency? Without genuine possibilities. Admittedly, our chess programs, like insects and fish, are much too simple agents to be plausible candidates for morally significant free will. But the determinism of their world does not rob them of their different powers, their different abilities to avail themselves of the opportunities presented. If we want to understand what is happening in that world, we may, indeed must, talk about how their informed choices cause their circumstances to change and about what they can and cannot do. If we want to uncover the causal regularities that account for the patterns we discover in those thousand games, we have to take seriously the perspective that describes the world as containing two agents, A and B, trying to beat each other in chess. Suppose we rig the tournament program so that whenever A wins, a bell rings, and whenever B wins, a buzzer sounds. We start the marathon, and an observer who knows nothing about the program notes that the bell rings quite frequently, the buzzer hardly ever. What explains this regularity, she wants to know. The regularity with which A beats B can be discerned and described independently of adopting the intentional stance, but it stands in need of explanation. The only explanation, the right explanation, may be that A generates better beliefs about what B will do if, than B generates about what A will do if. In such a case, adopting the intentional stance is required for finding the explanation. See chapters 33 and 42 for other examples of causal links that are utterly inexplicable until you adopt the intentional stance. So far, so good. But these decisions and choices seem to be only sordid decisions and choices. They lack something, it seems, that genuine choices have, could have done otherwise. But let's look more closely at a specific example, since appearances can be deceiving. It will help to add a third chess-playing program, C, to our tournament program. And let's suppose that C is better than A and B, beating them both almost all the time. And let's suppose that the first 12 moves in a pair of these games are exactly the same, and that C wins both games, beating both A and B, though by somewhat different routes after those first 12 moves. The experts huddle in retrospect and figure out that at move 12, the last common move, if either A or B had castled, C would likely have lost. Castling at move 12 was the key to victory, missed by both A and B. The designer of program A shrugs and says, "Well, A could have castled," and the designer of B adds, "My program too, B could have castled." But the designer of A was right, and the designer of B was wrong. How could this be? The tournament program, T, is deterministic. And if we run through the games again in exactly the same state, neither A nor B castles. Isn't the designer of A kidding herself? Not necessarily. What are we trying to find out when we ask if A could have done otherwise? Looking at precisely the same case again and again is utterly uninformative. But looking at similar cases is, in fact, diagnostic. If we find that in many similar circumstances in other games, A does pursue the evaluation slightly farther, discovering the virtues of such moves and making them, then we support the designer's conviction that A could have castled then. We might find, in the minimal case, that flipping a single bit in the pseudo-random number generator would have resulted in A's castling. Suppose A's designer digs deep down into the actual execution of the program and shows that on this occasion A stopped thinking one pulse too early. Every chess program, no matter how brilliant, has to truncate its searches arbitrarily at some point. A considered castling and had begun its analysis of that outcome, but since time was running out, it consulted its random number generator, flipping a coin in effect, and settled on the move it had so far identified as the best, and it wasn't castling. But if the pseudo-random number had been a 1 instead of a 0, A would have gone on considering for a little while longer and castled instead. "Just flip one bit in the random number and A wins," says the designer. We would say that in this case, A's failure to castle was a fluke, bad luck with the random number generator. When we turn to the designer of B, no such story in support of the claim that B could have castled under the circumstances is forthcoming. It is true that B knows that castling is legal under these conditions, and perhaps actually briefly considered castling. But B was nowhere near choosing castling on this occasion. Castling was a deep move, the sort of move that is followed by exclamation point in the newspaper chess columns, and far beyond Program B's limited analytical powers. So here we have an entirely deterministic world, Program T, in which A could have castled, but B could not have castled. The difference between A and B is real and explanatory, a difference in competence or ability. One way we could put it is apparently paradoxical. A could have castled at time T, but the universe couldn't have had a castling event at time T. What could possibly license this way of describing the situation? Simply this. If we consider A divorced from its immediate environment, which includes the random number generator, then whether A castles or not is undetermined. It depends on something that is, strictly speaking, outside A. Given the way the rest of the universe was arranged at T, castling was not possible for A. But that is not A's fault. B, in contrast, could not have castled. It was not in B's nature to castle. To imagine B castling would require too many alterations of reality. This is a useful discovery, a distinction between what A and B could do that does not depend on indeterminism. Even in a deterministic world, we can see that A can do kinds of things that B cannot do. And this difference is part of the explanation of why A beats B. The fact that, because determinism is true in this world, A and B can only do what they actually do on the specific occasion, and would do it again and again if exactly the same circumstances were repeated, is simply not interesting, not relevant to the explanation we get of the perfectly objective and visible regularity A beats B. A chess-playing program is not a moral agent, and it is not morally responsible for the choices it makes. Its world is entirely amoral, and violating one of the rules of chess is simply unthinkable for a chess program, and hence requires no penalties for violations. But as we have just seen, even in the simple deterministic world of computer chess, we can make a real and important distinction between A and B. Sometimes when A does something stupid or clever, we can say, A could have done otherwise, but B could not have done otherwise. If you think that this must be a mistake, because neither A nor B could ever have done otherwise since the world is deterministic, it is you making the mistake. A and B differ in chess competence, and could have done otherwise nicely captures an aspect of that difference, as we have just seen. What about moral competence? When people say of some human beings who act badly that they could have done otherwise, and use this as their justification for not excusing them, while agreeing that other human beings in similar circumstances could not have done otherwise, they are not making a mistake either. And this is independent of whether or not determinism is true. They are pointing to a real difference in moral competence that does not depend on either indeterminism or determinism, and that can ground a difference in our response. To see this more clearly, take the perspective of the programmer who designed program B. She wants to know if she has uncovered a weakness in B. Here is a game in which not castling cost B the victory. Could B have castled then? If all it would take for that to happen was the flip of a single bit in the random number generator, then perhaps no design improvements are called for. As often as not, in similar circumstances, B will castle, and perhaps that's as good as anyone could hope for. A program must always use random numbers now and then, as coin flips, to terminate search and get on with the game, and hence there will always be cases where, thanks to the flip, the search stops just this side of discovery. And notice that the situation is not improved if we give program B, or program A, a quantum random number generator, say a Geiger counter that spews out bits based on the undetermined trajectories of subatomic particles. Then consider what we would say about B in the case where B doesn't castle because of a single zero where a one might have been. If the quantum number generator yields a zero, B castles. If it yields a one, B doesn't castle. B could have castled, says an observer when the one comes up. Yes, but B is no freer for all that. In a series of games in which this sort of opportunity comes up, half the time B will castle and half the time B won't, whether B's random number generator is genuine or pseudo. The philosopher David Wiggins, 1973, page 54, once wrote of the cosmic unfairness of determinism. But what our intuition pump about the computer chess tournament shows is the equal cosmic unfairness of indeterminism. B is at the mercy of its random number generator, or its pseudo-random number generator. So, of course, is A, so are we all. There is no reason to prefer the genuinely random number generator, unless, of course, you plan to play chess against an omniscient god who can see into your pseudo-random number generator and plan accordingly. So, we're still looking for a reason to want indeterminism to be true. Perhaps we can have all the free will worth wanting without indeterminism playing any role. Here's another candidate reason. I can't change the past, but if indeterminism is true, I can change the future. Nope. Change the future from what to what? From what it was going to be to what it is going to be? You can no more change the future than you can change the past. The concept is incoherent. So, if determinism is true, I can't change the future. And if determinism is false, I can't change the future. So it follows that I can't change the future. Why does it seem that we want to change the future? Because we want to be able to foresee disasters and do something so those disasters don't happen. And we can do this independently of indeterminism. If somebody throws a brick at you, and you see it and duck, you can avoid being hit by the brick. Good for you. Was the collision going to happen? In one sense, yes, since the brick was clearly on a trajectory right for your head. But since you saw it, since you were caused to see it by the light bouncing off of it into your eyes where your brain calculated the risk and was caused to take action, you avoided it. Of course, if you had wanted to avoid avoiding it, if some reason had occurred to you for why you might actually do better by letting it hit you, you could do just that. Some observer might not be able to tell, right up to the last moment, whether you were going to take the hit or not. And if he was betting on you to duck, he'd lose. We're back at our reason for wanting to be unpredictable, which does not require indeterminism. What does this intuition pump accomplish? It takes the familiar phrase, could have done otherwise, and shows that contrary to widespread but ill-examined opinion, a valuable version of it does not depend on indeterminism. If there is a sense of could have done otherwise that is both incompatible with determinism and morally important, not merely a metaphysical curiosity, you might say, this has yet to be established, and the burden of proof lies with those who think so. One more obvious point exposed as not so obvious after all. 71. Ultimate responsibility. So far, we've been looking at trivial choices, not involving moral responsibility at all. Rock, paper, scissors, chess moves, and brick ducking. Perhaps it is when we are specifically looking at our attempts to be moral agents, not just intentional systems like chess-playing computers and stotting gazelles, that indeterminism is truly desirable. Many thinkers have thought so. For them, these exercises are just so much distraction. Here is a nice, clear version of what some thinkers take to be the decisive argument. It is due in this form to the philosopher Galen Strawson, 2010. 1. You do what you do in any given situation because of the way you are. 2. So in order to be ultimately responsible for what you do, you have to be ultimately responsible for the way you are, at least in certain crucial mental respects. 3. But you cannot be ultimately responsible for the way you are in any respect at all. 4. So you cannot be ultimately responsible for what you do. The first premise is undeniable. The way you are is meant to include your total state at the time, however you got into it. Whatever state it is, your action flows from it non-miraculously. The second premise observes that you couldn't be ultimately responsible for what you do unless you were ultimately responsible for getting yourself into that state, at least in some regards. But according to step 3, this is impossible. So step 4, the conclusion, does seem to follow logically. Several thinkers have found this argument decisive and important, but is it really? Let's look more closely at step 3. Why can't you be ultimately responsible for some respects, at least, of the way you are? In everyday life, we make exactly this distinction, and it matters morally. Suppose you design and build a robot, and send it out into the world unattended and unsupervised, and knowing full well the sorts of activities it might engage in. And suppose it seriously injures somebody. Aren't you responsible for this, at least in some respects? Most people would say so. You made it. You should have foreseen the dangers. Indeed, you did foresee some of the dangers, and now you are to blame, at least in part, for the damage done. Few would have any sympathy for you if you insisted that you weren't responsible at all for the harm done by your robot. Now consider a slightly different case. You design and build a person, yourself, at a later time, and send yourself out into the risky world, knowing full well the possible dangers you would encounter. You get yourself drunk in a bar and then get in your car and drive off. Aren't you responsible, at least in part, for the way you were when you crashed into a school bus? Common sense says, of course, the bartender or your compliant host may share the responsibility. But how could this be in the face of Strawson's knockdown argument? Well, remember that Strawson says you can't be absolutely responsible for the way you are. Okay, but so what? Who would think it was important to be absolutely responsible? That is indeed a state that is utterly impossible, even if indeterminism is true. So much for the idea that this argument gives us a reason for hoping for indeterminism. Here is what Strawson, 2010, says. To be absolutely responsible for what one does, one would have to be causa sui, the cause of oneself, and this is impossible. It certainly wouldn't be more possible if we had immaterial souls rather than being wholly material. Absolute responsibility is a red herring, a blessing nobody should hanker for. Strawson, 2003, thinks otherwise and criticizes me for neglecting it. He doesn't establish the kind of absolute free will and moral responsibility that most people want to believe in and do believe in. That can't be done, and he knows it. He's exactly right. I don't establish the kind of free will most people want to believe in, and I know it. But I think they are wrong to want to believe in it, and wrong to believe in it if they do. The burden falls on Strawson and others to show why we ought to care about ultimate responsibility, or the determinism-indeterminism issue in our lives. They can define a variety of free will that is incompatible with determinism and show that lots of folks think that's important. But they also need to show that those folks aren't deceiving themselves. Why should anybody care? Note my rhetorical question. I'm leading with my chin. I would be happy for Strawson or somebody else to step up to the plate and try to answer it, but so far there are no volunteers. Before leaving Strawson's argument, let me ask if you have noticed its uncanny resemblance to an earlier argument. I will revise the earlier argument into a form a little closer to Strawson's to bring out the similarities. 1. A mammal is a mammal in any given context because of the way it is. 2. In order to be a mammal, you have to become the way you are by having a mammal for a mother. 3. But this must be true of your mother and her mother and so forth ad infinitum, which is impossible. 4. So you cannot be a mammal because mammals are utterly impossible. You should always be leery of any such ancestral argument. It is almost certain to be a disguised instance of the ancient fallacy known as the Sorites, or heap argument. 1. A single grain of wheat is not a heap. 2. Adding a grain to a single grain does not make a heap. 3. You can't make a non-heap into a heap by adding a single grain. 4. Therefore, there are no such things as heaps. Philosophers have written about the Sorites paradox and the problems of the vague boundaries of terms, which is what the paradox obviously depends on, for thousands of years, and there is still no resolution of just how to diagnose and avoid the fallacy. See the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy online for an excellent and up-to-the-minute survey. There are even a few brave philosophers who declare the Sorites to be valid, and they try to live with the fact that there are no bald men and no non-bald men either. Tough position to defend. But as Chapter 43 showed, Darwin taught us how to turn our backs on the Sorites. We don't need to find principled dividing lines between categories ranked in ancestral order. To my knowledge, I am the first to point out the resemblance of Strawson's argument, and the other arguments of this ilk in the free will literature, to a Sorites paradox. But there it is. I think it is just as obvious that people can gradually become morally responsible during their passage from infancy to adulthood, as it is that lineages of reptiles and then therapsids can gradually become a lineage of mammals over the eons. You don't have to be an absolute mammal to be a mammal, and you don't have to be absolutely responsible to be responsible, or have absolute free will to have a kind of free will worth wanting. In fact, since absolute free will would be miraculous, there really needs to be a powerful argument to show why anybody would covet such a thing. Do they want to be God? Too bad, they're out of luck. But the next best thing is quite a good thing to be. 72. Sphexishness. Doug Hofstetter, 1982, coined the term sphexishness for a familiar sort of rigid, robotic mindlessness that is often mistaken for great cleverness. This defining example of sphexishness, and the source of the term, is a wasp with a curious behavior. Doug and I had independently been struck by a passage in a popular science book, The Machinery of the Brain, written by Dean Woolridge, 1963, who described the sphex wasp thus. When the time comes for egg laying, the wasp, sphex, builds a burrow for the purpose and seeks out a cricket, which she stings in such a way as to paralyze but not kill it. She drags the cricket into the burrow, lays her eggs alongside, closes the burrow, then flies away, never to return. In due course, the eggs hatch, and the wasp grubs feed off the paralyzed cricket, which has not decayed, having been kept in the wasp equivalent of deep freeze. To the human mind, such an elaborately organized and seemingly purposeful routine conveys a convincing flavor of logic and thoughtfulness, until more details are examined. For example, the wasp's routine is to bring the paralyzed cricket to the burrow, leave it on the threshold, go inside to see that all is well, emerge, and then drag the cricket in. If the cricket is moved a few inches away while the wasp is inside making her preliminary inspection, the wasp, on emerging from the burrow, will bring the cricket back to the threshold but not inside, and will then repeat the preparatory procedure of entering the burrow to see that everything is all right. If again the cricket is removed a few inches while the wasp is inside, once again she will move the cricket up to the threshold and re-enter the burrow for a final check. The wasp never thinks of pulling the cricket straight in. On one occasion, this procedure was repeated 40 times, always with the same result. Page 82. A perfect example, it seems, of the imperfect, uncomprehending competence